Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Cosmology and Science podcast. In this episode, we're talking with the cybernetics expert and philosopher Ian Glendinning about science, emergence, Robert Pirsig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Ian McGilchrist's The Matter with Things, and the relationship and balance between science and what lies beyond. So thanks so much for listening and for tuning in, and enjoy the show. So we met originally through the Channel McGilchrist forums, and I've always been impressed and very inspired by your comments there and your ideas, and also the innumerable emails we've been having back and forth over the last couple of months. I'm especially fascinated by my sense that you are somewhat of a mix of a rationalist, humanist, scientist, but you also have an open mind to that there is something beyond. And it also seems you have at least two big things in common, which is Robert Pirsig's book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and Ian McGilchrist's The Matter with Things, and The Master and His Emissary. So thanks so much for taking the time, and welcome to the podcast.
That's great. Pleasure. As you've suggested, we have a lot of things in common to talk about. So
yeah, I've been really looking forward to this
one. You stay in charge, otherwise we'll be here forever.
Yeah. So I think we could start with just one of your blog posts recently about the new book about Robert Pirsig and his the collection of writings that has now come out. So if you could just say something about the book and why you like it and what do you think about it now, kind of a couple of decades after the originals.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a new book. It's just literally published this week, in fact. It might even be today, I think. So as you said in the introduction, we know about Pirsig's original Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Few people know about his follow-up book, Lila, which elaborates on his thinking. And this is Wendy, his widow, almost exactly 5 years after his death, pulling together a collection of writings on quality, and it's quality is the subject of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I started, ironically, when I read, as Wendy did, when she actually put a preface in the book, she starts a little bit of Bob's own story, Robert Pirsig's story. The original book is actually full of autobiographical content. It's a road journey, you know, a road movie type plot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is flashbacks of Pirsig's life. But of course, it carries this warning that it's a rhetorical book. Things have been changed for rhetorical purposes, so you don't know how much of it is real. So there's been a running story alongside the book of how much of it is really Pirsig's life and how much of it is just his imagination. So I'm one of the people who spent quite a lot of time at least documenting the biography without actually writing and publishing one. And Wendy puts about 8 pages in the beginning of the book of just a potted history of Bob so that we all get it. And I obviously, because of my interest in that, picked up on that when I first read the book, the On Quality book. Mm-hmm. But in fact, that's just the first few pages. So the book is fundamentally on quality. And so it just elaborates from those original two book writings, mm-hmm. A collection of interviews that he did with the guys writing the guidebook to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, DeSanto and Steele, and with another guy called Dan Glover, who did again, a similar book following on from Lila called Lila's Child. So Bob put a lot of contributions into those books, as well as his own writing. So a lot of the extracts are actually taken from those four sources. Mm-hmm. They're all Bob's words, but they're all taken from those four sources. But what she's also done is added into that. He entered into correspondence with a lot of people. So there's a lot of letters between him and other people. So what she's done is just taken his words out of lots of the letters as well. So there's a whole section of letters. And he also did, again, he was a bit of a recluse. He only did about four or five actual talks on his subject to external audiences in his life. But he's got notes from those talks as well. So again, some of the content is from those. And finally, of course, some of the content is actually quotes from, you know, Zen Buddhism from Tao Te Ching and so on, and other sources directly quotes from people as well. It covers the whole of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a latecomer to Robert Pearcey. Yeah. I have to admit, as many other people I've discovered, I heard a lot about it in my early 20s, but then it was kind of this kind of the hippie Bible, as some people label it, and I just never got to read it. And now I did, like 15 years later, I'm just blown away by how deep it is with philosophy and his whole struggling with both his quality concept, kind of the in some ways he's alluding to this deeper into the book about like it has similarities to the good of Plato or like the Buddha, and like it's this kind of thing he's striving towards understanding and capturing, but also the whole idea of the some people might say the science and the humanities, or as he called it, the romantic and the classical view, like this whole two worlds, but it's also two experiences of the world, and also kind of it's similar to the two brain hemispheres as well. So all of this was just mind-blowing for me reading this and discovering it.
And in many ways, although it's now 20-ish years for me, I was a latecomer to it as well. So I missed it when I could have in my teens as a student. And I actually missed it again in when was it? Probably the late 80s, when I was actually doing a master's degree, and it was actually on the reading list. Uh-huh. Because one of the very topical things in management at that time was the concept of excellence. And of course, quality management came in a big way into industry. And his book was actually on that reading list. One of the books I never read because I just never saw the point of it at the time.
Yeah.
And how I came to read it, you're absolutely right. It's this, you've summarized it between the classic and romantic or left and right brain. And a lot of these things are like, he uses the word quality, but whether it's the Tao or the Buddha or the good, these are essentially synonymous as far as he's concerned, because they're actually rather deliberately hard to define things. That's the point, in fact. I started my quest for the something missing. I'm an engineer in a sort of fairly objective mechanical world, and I was already in through the we started but probably started in the 80s, but through the 90s I was already, there's something missing here, we're missing something, but by sort of modeling and automating everything, we're missing something. So I had that quest already before we got to the millennium, and I started actively on it literally the millennium. And I hadn't read Robert Pearcey at that point. And the reason I actually read him was because I saw two Nobel Prize winning physicists who were actually working in Cambridge at the time. One of them was based at the Cavendish, Brian Josephson, just write an article together, which just mentioned Zen Buddhism. And I thought, sorry, this is Nobel Prize winning physicist talking about, you know, some interesting lessons from Zen Buddhism. And I thought, it just blew my mind in a way. I just thought, what? And that's when I just suddenly went, oh, everything sort of unraveled. I had to rush back and find that book with Zen in the title. What was it called again?
Yeah.
Two of those people, one of them, Brian, that's I've mentioned Brian Josephson. And the other one is Henry Stapp, who in fact I've written about more recently, who's also pursued this much further in science. Maybe come back to him.
Yeah.
Later.
So just for listeners who haven't read the book and this the word of the quality. So yeah. One thing that fascinated me was when he describes, so it's so in a sense precise, his experience of how the brain hemispheres are working, but he doesn't know technically that this is what happening. That's what happening. This is my interpretation though, but he describes like the qual, as long as he keeps the quality idea in his right hemisphere, the kind of more holistic kind of perceiving mode of being, he kind of knows what it is, but once he tries to define it and then he moves it into the left hemisphere, he destroys some of it. So that's, it's a very precise description of actually technically what is happening in the brain. But if what is your short explanation or description of the quality idea that he's trying to reach for?
So he sees it as synonymous with a lot of these other ancient ideas. And as you say, also this idea, as soon as you start to conceptualize and describe and define it, it disappears. You know, the tower that can be known is not the tower. And, you know, these are not new ideas, but he just uses the same expressions. And in fact, he was deliberately avoiding this, what he called the subject-object split, which is that instantly going into the subjective stuff versus the objective model of the real world. And in fact, what he goes in, he actually, by the time he gets to the second book, starts to talk about a so-called static and dynamic split. But what became dynamic quality and what was just plain quality in the first book, in fact, it's pure experience. It is just the act of experiencing. And it's the act of experiencing. You know that you're socially conditioned by everything you already know. So you know when you see something, you're going to interpret it based on not just what you see. I mean, we were intelligent enough to understand that's how we are. But the quality is just that experience, you know, the pre-conceptual experience, just pure experience. And again, he knew he wasn't being entirely original. His originality was in actually using the word quality and then building a fairly complex structure of metaphysics around it, which isn't actually elaborated in this latest book.
I think he describes like the origin is something that when he's working as an academic at university with students, and there's something about like there needs to be quality in the papers they're writing. And then somebody's like, what does quality mean? Or something that. And then suddenly he's kind of taken a bit aback and like, yeah, what is quality? I know what it is, but I can't describe it. And then
yes, exactly. So he called this is the seed crystal idea. So what he so a lot of it is his own biography. So yes, he was a English school, you know, English teacher in school, and he was teaching, you know, essay writing and rhetoric and what have you. And yes, he got to this point where he was struggling with his students to have them not come to him for a set of rules about, you've asked us to write about this, tell us, you know, tell us the rules of what's going to make it a good essay. And he was obviously, and he started a lot of non-prescriptive teaching where he just allowed them, you know, allowed them to do a work that would just be judged on quality by the people hearing it in the classroom. And no marks were assigned to things. He was quite radical at the time and came into conflict with his educational employers. But yes, exactly. So, and he was already thinking of these things, but very much in that context of what makes a good piece of rhetoric, what's a good essay for an English student to write. And that's where it started. And it's been cast into this seed crystal where one of his colleagues, Sarah Vinke, at the same institution, just in a throwaway remark said, I hope you're teaching quality. And that's when he just quality, that's exactly what it is I'm looking for. And that's part of the story. So although it's not in the narrative of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is a cross USA, you know, buddy road movie type thing on it, it's part of the backstory that's woven into the narrative.
Yeah. I mean, and it's already from the start of the book, you see how, at least in my view again, how he is struggling with of the abstract immaterial world and the material world, or kind of how he seems like a very strong analytical thinker. Like his left brain is really, really, he has a good engine or machine going there.
That's right.
But he tips over into the other, like already from the beginning when he talks about, for example, the existence of immaterial things, when he talks about the motorcycle, when he says it's really a miniature study of the art of rationality itself. If you work on the motorcycle, working well, caring is to become part of a process to achieve an inner peace of mind. The motorcycle is primarily a mental phenomenon. Just one of countless examples when he's trying to express that, like his love of the motorcycle and fixing it, it starts in his mind. It's an abstract construct in or reality in his mind first. Yep. So,
yes, he was a mechanic, had a very elaborate workshop. He was a pretty meticulous mechanic himself. So he was, you know, as you say, very fine-tuned on the physical world. But as you say, what he was really saying is, and it comes out in so many other areas of modeling the physical world, is that it starts in mind, or at least starts in much more less concrete areas of certainly, you know, what does it do? So his first breakdown of the motorcycle, which is carries on throughout the book, is in terms of its functional components. What do the different things do? And then how do they get realized in material and connected together in such a way that they do actually work and you can maintain them? My particular, obviously, the motorcycle is front and center throughout the whole book. But one of my favorite parts in that story is that he, as part of just an after dinner conversation with people in Bozeman, he starts to talk to the guests about this assembly of just a self-assembly barbecue, which was being used by the host. And he gets to think about, okay, it looks like a set of instructions, you know, 10 lines on a piece of paper, but you need to get into the head of the person that was writing it. And what did they think you were going to achieve with it? And what's the barbecue meant to do? So it's quite a good elaboration of this functional view of what the thing is meant to actually do versus the actual mechanical concrete picture of the parts.
Yeah. I mean, he's tapping into this all the time. You have this idea also that anytime, just going to say aha moment for sometimes that anytime you see any letters writing in like in the street or on a building or something, it always originates in somebody's mind. Everything always starts in the head of somebody who punches it in onto the keyboard. So it's just like the source of things are more like in the abstract again, unless you want to say that the brain is material and the thoughts are mechanically movements.
This is where this conversation does lead us, of course, is into those fundamental questions.
So but you have so I have more quotes that I love from the book. He said that the Buddha, the Godhead, resides quite as comfortably in the circuits of a digital computer or the gears of a cycle transmission as he does at the top of a mountain or in the petals of a flower. So that quote is something that immediately brings my thoughts to like medieval thinking, medieval theology, like the spiritual is a separate realm, but it's united. So it's everywhere. And it's a bit like you think about math as well, like the mathematical dimension is everywhere. And it's united, but it's not in necessarily in the cup, but it is united with like it permeates everything. So
yeah, in Platonic sense, it's something that's the essence of things. It is there, whatever the thing is, and it is much more abstract. Yes.
Yeah. It's one of the things that when I read it, I thought that if like he's born into a scientific age. If he was born into a more if he was born into like next to the monasteries in the 1100s of France, I think he could have been a monk easily.
Oh yes.
Because he has also a huge talent, I would say, for trying to think in like both of these worlds. But I think the problem comes very often from that he tries to unite it from the left hemisphere, from the logical side. And that just doesn't work. You have to do it.
Certainly starts at that side because, of course, his audience in a really is his traveling companions, John Sutherland. Yeah, they're living in a world where they're seeing the benefits of modern progress in terms of the latest motors. He's got the latest motorcycle and he's the latest technology at home and so on. But is not interested in understanding it. He just takes it for granted that it's clever Western technology that he can use. And so a lot of his thinking is really is treating him as his audience. He's talking to them, explaining to them how they need to understand what really goes into these things, what's behind them, and how fundamental it is that it's actually not. It's the same sort of thinking that's behind any kind of creative progress in history of humanity, really.
Yeah. I mean, they also sometimes they represent, like John and his wife represent, in some sense, like the general assumptions or the general response from the culture at the time or the society.
He just personifies that. That's
exactly.
Right.
So when he talks about, they talk about ghosts in the beginning and then if they exist or not, because if you can't see them and touch them, they don't exist. And then it talks about the law of gravity. Like, does that exist? And for how long has that existed? Did the law of gravity exist before the Big Bang, for example? So then already there your head might start spinning when you're reading it because he points, he kind of pushes those right little spots where you just have to, I mean, maybe what he's doing is that he goes to the limits of the left hemisphere domain again, like the rational scientific domain, and he just shows at this point, like, where do you go from here? So,
yeah, well, of course, the other thing that you and I have touched on before is, of course, that he does, as you say, do it from the inside out, from the left out, from that perspective. But of course, getting close to the edge to see what's on the other side is very much this, you know, edge of madness kind of thing. And of course, another one of the threads of the story is, of course, his own mental health. And the fact that he was seen as mad because he was this person with a fairly clear job that was to get these students to pass these exams and so on. But he was so tied up in the thinking of, yes, but what is good, that he was almost paralyzed from doing what would appear to be a relatively straightforward day job. And that, you know, that was the period when he did, in fact, institutionalized.
I don't think it was helpful for him or healthy to be in an institution and such a kind of institutionalized system of thinking, given his nature. I think it amplified his. I mean, I think his.
Yes, he calls it the Church of Reason. You know, there's this somehow edifice of what knowledge is supposed to be, and stray outside its bounds, you're a heretic, sort of thing. Yeah.
Yep, and I think that made his left hemisphere become his enemy because it got too much control, too much stimulus, too much kind of confirmation from day to day. But I mean, it's just the impact of a structure around you. If you're in an institution, it could be massive, much more than we are aware of usually. So, So,
a lot of that is still there, even though it might be invisible and taken for granted these days, because a lot of this stuff becomes part of the infrastructure. So, you know, so these days we don't think twice about the fact that we have this instant electronic communication and sharing space of all sorts of information.
I mean, there's a sidestepping, but it's like people talk about architecture, how much that enforces your left or your right hemisphere.
Yeah.
Because if you have straight lines everywhere, your left brain is super happy, but your right brain is, it gets...
And as you've probably noticed, you know, architecture, definitely, I use systems thinking is the jargon I'm sort of using now, but I, you know, just architecture is the key word that I've been using all the way through as well. Because it's about the shape of things and topology as opposed to detail, you know, the arrangements of things, the general shape of things, not the architecture as in precisely what size the windows are and things like that. But
yeah,
you know,
I guess that's your point.
So I tend to use the word architecture, and that's actually what, if we're going to come on to McGilchrist next, of course, that's exactly why I latched onto McGilchrist, not just from this picking up again on this classic romantic or left and right, whatever metaphor you want to use. You know, McGilchrist obviously brings this left and right metaphor into an actual reality. Actually, this is not just a metaphor. This is actually reflected in the way the brain works. But again, when he does it, he's still avoiding this cortical fallacy that everything that matters is the hemispheres of the brain. And it's not. What he's really saying is the way these two hemispheres talk to each other and to the other parts of the brain are what matters. And that's architecture. In my book, that's architecture. You know, it's how these pieces are arranged relative to each other that matters.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's almost like we can marvel at the brain architecture again then, because it seems to be way beyond our level of technology, even if you want to use that language, like how it's constructed, how it's uniting two different things that...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm taking you off track a bit here, but we're supposed to just tell me when to stop. But exactly. Yeah. That's why most of my excitement now is about how this stuff gets reflected in systems architectures, because...
Yeah.
Obviously, for, you know, in recent years with mechanization and automation and more computer systems automation and the dreaded word algorithms and what have you.
It's a nice topic to shift to, because I'm just a couple of two last quotes there from Pirsig's book.
Okay,
he talks about the divorce of art from technology is completely unnatural. It's just that it's gone on so long that you have to be an archaeologist to find out where the two separated. Rotisserie assembly is actually a long-lost branch of sculpture, so divorced from its roots by centuries of intellectual wrong turns that just to associate the two sounds ludicrous. And then he also, later in the book, he talks about how he wants to unite these two worlds of the sciences and the arts. He says there, what brought tears of recognition to my eyes was the discovery that these unfinished edges match perfectly in a kind of harmony, that both Phaedrus, that is kind of his ghost, his old personality that ended up in the mental hospital, and Poincaré talked about. So here it is. To produce a complete structure of thought capable of uniting the separate languages of science and art into one. So I took that as kind of one of his main ambitions and aspirations for his life work, almost, just to try to unite this. And
we think of it the two cultures, or however you think of that. That division was an artificial thing that happened probably out of necessity in people actually doing practical things. But a lot of it he shows, as you say, it's archaeology. It's really in the etymology of various words. But the three letters RTA, you know, he has quite a long riff on that. How arts, crafts, and have based around the same roots. The fact that we've made them into two different things is the artificial thing that we've done. It's not natural.
If you only go back to the Latin, science means a body of knowledge. And art means the skill or the craft to do something. So that has completely changed in our days how we use these two terms.
Science has become the method rather than just the body of knowledge. Absolutely, that's right. Indeed. And that method gets applied to all sorts, every whether it's government or business or whether it's whatever it is. It becomes the.
It's also kind of it's not a filter, but it becomes a bit of an obstacle if you read old ancient and medieval writings, because when they talk about arts and sciences, it's not the same.
It really is the way around this way.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
So, but this uniting thing is also, I'm going back to the 1200s and the universities when they have theology, because theology was the queen of the sciences, and that was like the spiritual overarching structure that embedded everything, and they would have thought like to try to make science the overall embedding thing would just not work, would be the thinking at the time. So just as like a side comment, that this has been thought and pondered many times before, and they also developed, like the whole of Dante's Comedy is one example of a complete cosmology integrating everything, including the sciences. It's like he sees an angel and kind of the divine light, but it goes then in an angle towards the surface, and it goes up in the same angle according to mathematics. Like it's just every page is he fuses things together, and it feels natural. Like your brain is fine with it.
So you know, I'm a fairly typical scientist, rationalist, engineer, sort of rationalist atheist, engineer. So that's me, and nothing we're saying here changes that. But at the same time, it's going to come up in the Megalochrist space again. This idea that there's more to the natural world than is modeled in science is really important to actually get back to this view that there's the unified world is more than science.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think it's a nice place to move on to the Megalochrist book. I had one quote from you that I saved here, which is exactly what you just said. That without necessarily invoking God as a supernatural being, it seems fine to recognize an ineffable sacred beyond science, but still natural. Beyond science, but still natural. I just remember reading it and thinking, this is how you can put it. This is a secular. Yeah. Rationalist description of something that is fairly acceptable.
Yeah, and the language I'm using now, even with these systems thinkers, who are basic, programmers in an IT world, is that two ways of saying the same thing. It's either natural theology or sacred naturalism. So either of those is a sort of portmanteau word for the what I think it is that we're now talking about.
Can you say a little bit about those two terms? Like, just to explain very shortly what you mean, again, for the listeners.
Well, in a way, it's just reflecting back the quote you've given to me, but just in a couple of words. So what I'm saying is the world contains stuff that is entirely natural, doesn't involve having to posit any supernatural, omniscient, omnipotent sort of being or agent, which will remain mysterious to science, or certainly science as it is currently known. But it's okay. It's still perfectly natural, and we can call it sacred. We're not going to fall out over it if we're going to call it sacred, or even as you said, it would have been called theology. Just thinking about this would have been called theology. So there are organizations who would brand themselves using those two terms, natural theology or sacred naturalism. And I'm happy to subscribe to those.
Yeah. I mean,
it's partly because people like McGilchrist and Saltons and others are actually now showing that, yes, that's exactly how our minds work.
Yeah.
It's not just a perception we get from all of these historical records. If you actually look inside a brain, that's how the brain works.
Yeah. And it's something about, yeah, again, like just looking at words and understanding old and new definitions, because sometimes what's seen as new now has been said before, but with words that we don't understand in the same way,
yes.
And then it becomes kind of blurred and kind of foggy for us. But just another sidestep. When people today say they're spiritual but not religious, that would make no sense in the medieval times. They would have no understanding what you meant, even, because if you're spiritual, then you are. That would be the same.
Yes.
Unless you ascribe to a certain system of organized religion. But like in general, like you're, if you're open again, to something beyond that, that is there, then.
Yeah. So I don't have a problem with the word religion. I prefer to think of religion as from its roots as, you know, that which binds us.
Yeah.
You know, the things that we declare that we share in common so that we can get on with life. So I'm happy with that. Obviously, my only problem with that is, as I say, I just don't see any deposit this supernatural, omnipotent, omnipresent entity. Have any dogma that's based around that. So that, obviously, that's where I would reject, you know, organized religion to use them.
Exactly. So I thought when we start talking about McGilchrist now, I'm also curious about what your impression of how science has added things to our knowledge, and also this the differences between, let's say, the material and the spiritual. And because it seems to me that there has been a concrete steps through the scientific thinking and language to acknowledging more of that there is a limitation, that there is something beyond. I was listening to another talk that's kind of related to this, which is about like immaterial forces, or like the immaterial agency, like just in a group, that the group has an agency that is there. It has a nature, it has characteristics. We know group psychology and how it works, and we can also engage in it and kind of have an influence on how this agency is working. But where the scientific like thinking puts a line is that it's not like it exists as a reality, as an agent, but it's not conscious, is not self-aware, it doesn't have self-consciousness. And I thought that was just a helpful language to kind of separate how to think about this, because it is obviously there, and the kind of the spirit of a city could be a thing that influences people living there.
And again, that's why Ian's book, Ian McGilchrist's book, has the title The Matter with Things, because part of the problem is what do you treat as a thing? And it's actually, there are certainly lots of good thinking going on. In fact, it's exactly what I'm talking in this area about, what I've been saying, systems thinking for short, but active inference is the latest buzzword. But there are definitely people who would appear to be on the modern scientific side of this, who are beginning to see descriptions of how things work that are exactly what you just described, which is this emergent thing is more than the sum of its parts, and actually has, you know, a life of its own. Whether it has an internal conscious life or not, it has a life of its own. And in fact, that's what life is. You know, it's another one of those metaphors that's exactly what life is.
Suddenly it becomes semantics. It depends how you define life then, or living.
Exactly. A definition of life. Yeah. Well, we can talk about definitions as well, if you like. That's another long story. but things are not defined by their definitions. So again, there is a lot of work happening in systems with free energy principle, Markov blankets, ergodicity, but basically strong emergence, as it used to be referred to, which was the idea that there are larger, in complex environments, there are larger objects that seem to materialize, and you can talk about them as having properties of their own and having even causation of their own.
Yeah.
But a reductionist scientist would say, ah, yes, but that's only the net result of all of these atoms and what have you down here creating that. So you get into these ridiculous positions of, you know, consciousness isn't real, free will isn't real. Yeah. You know, they're just epiphenomena that make us feel better. And I consider those to be ridiculous positions.
Yeah, I mean, but this is very it's super interesting. Mm, but it's like if you, I'm just wondering if you. If you can't, I mean, this is the old Greek thinking, like that the sum is more than the, or like the whole is more than the sum of the parts. But if you can't, if you can't predict the characteristics of the sum of something from the parts, then you have a bit of, it's not a scientific problem, but it's just like, then it is something.
And science has a problem. And in fact, you know, I've been referring to it as a bug with something. You know, science has a bug, which it is kind of excluding that kind of thinking. It always comes back to this reductionist thing. And it, not surprisingly, by excluding the subjective, science can't explain consciousness. Well, that's no surprise. You need to recognize that the conscious is real, just as real as the subjective is real, just as real as the objective.
So where is the science? This is right at the kind of most interesting part, I think, to see how maybe a couple of years, centuries of the scientific kind of paradigm, or like the era, if it might be changing, by like the nature of it might be changing kind of these decades, I don't know, 50 years or so. Developments. So if you can just talk more about that, that would be great.
Yes, so this is really up to date stuff now, and in fact, we're talking this in relation to McGilchrist, and he does this from both sort of internal science, neuroscience, but also from a psychology, external behavior, and seeing the thinking through the behavior. But it always leaves us with this problem of, what is it that's doing the thinking? You know, what is it that's making decisions around this behavior? And Ian's very good at relating this to lots of different schools, the kind of things that we've been talking about, that some of this stuff is in ancient culture, it's in art, it's in psychology, even though it would be seen as completely remote from science. I think most of what he says is true. I think Ian misses a trick in getting to the ultimate explanation of how this is going to be resolved, other than just accepting that this other space exists. So Ian still ends up essentially dualist, in the sense that he does see the model of the world that science builds and the reality as we perceive it in the right brain, and they talk to each other, but they're still two different things, I think, in Ian's model at the end, which is good. And there's a lot of stuff in there which I'd seen before I saw it in Ian's book. Obviously, the fantastic thing about Ian's book, particularly The Matter with Things, is that it's such a synthesis of a lot of stuff. So it's going to be a fantastic reference work for a lot of time to come.
Oh, yeah.
Even if people have picked up bits and run with it already since. But as a reference source, synthesis of so much previous research and his own research from his own time as a psychiatrist as well.
I think it's one of the biggest books of the century. I think, yeah, and I also think if you got Aristotle or Dante back like in today, I think they would really look into McGilchrist's work and think like, oh, this this is moving the ball forward here. This is insights, even if things were expressed from the experience point of view in the ancient world. There is something. There's a concrete step forward, I would say, with McGilchrist's work. But it's also interesting what you say, that if it is fundamentally a left hemi-, I mean, he is a scientist, like the whole book is a scientific endeavor. So if he ends up with a dualism,
about McGilchrist now.
Yeah, McGilchrist, yes. So that
interesting.
It ends up then with that form of dualism would be the left hemisphere's conclusion, even with a bit of humility that like it has limitations, and it's shown through its own workings, its own he walks us rationally to the boundaries and looks a little bit beyond, and then he goes back again. So so it's kind of a more humble left hemisphere, but it's still that model would sound like that we still
I think when we set this up, you originally phrased this as a question about, you know, just what are my favorite parts of McGilchrist, and in a way, you know, part of it is the bit that we were already talking about, which is essentially a systems architecture view of how it works. A lot of which I'd already been researching, and some of it was in his previous book, of course. And so we had, and I my main finding reading those sections of Ian's book was we just had lots of the same sources. He, when I looked at all his references, they were like, oh, I've read that. So not surprisingly, we had an awful lot of similar views of how it came to be like that. But the most important part of Ian's book is the bit that's not what you just said, which is at the end, his culminating chapter is the sense of the sacred. Yeah. So I mean, you could tell, I've watched Ian give several talks since the book now about it. You could tell this is the bit that still hits hardest with him, is that he's a scientist, he's written a scientific book,
yeah,
but he put this chapter in at the end, and now he's standing by that and answering that question to everybody, you know, what did you mean by the sense of the sacred? So I've very glibly gone on, yeah, well, it's just natural theology or sacred naturalism. So I've kind of said, yes, I agree, and moved on. But he's clearly still wrestling with this and yeah, finding the language to talk to more people about it as a scientist.
I think he said in one interview that he's gotten feedback that some people say, I wish you had left that chapter, the last chapter 27 or 28 out, because everything else is solid, rational, scientific, but then the last chapter is a bit beyond, kind of is outside of the scope of the book, or like that kind of critique. But I love some of these he goes through much of theology again, or ideas of the sacred. But what struck me was when he describes his own personal experience, like going out in nature and looking at the ocean and kind of the feeling of uniting with, or kind of communing with nature, and just that experience. I think that's very beautiful, because I think it's something many people can relate to, that you lose yourself when you're alone in nature, but you're still conscious, but you kind of, it's just,
you understand it in a particular way by experiencing it, by being in it, being part of it.
Yeah.
So you know you're experiencing it in a different way. You're not asking questions about, you know, Darwin and molecules. You're just in it and experiencing it. And which is why, of course, it lines up so well with Persig, you know, in this pure experience idea being at the root of, well, in Persig's sense, it's at the root of everything. You know, even the stuff we call physics is still at root.
And maybe that creates the internal conflict or kind of battle again, because that's most likely your right hemisphere being in charge for a few moments and giving you an experience, and then it's there.
Yes, and that's a bit, I find a little bit disingenuous in some of today's public scientists, is that they will actually also talk in this kind of language in terms of awe, looking at the night sky, and awe when they're out in nature, and, you know, David Attenborough or whoever, Brian Cox, whoever, you know, they will talk this way, but they will always treat it as something different from the serious stuff.
Yeah.
They will talk about it as being part of their motivation, probably, and you know, why they're interested and inspired to do things. But they will never use it as part of what they see as their day job.
Yeah.
And I find that a little disingenuous. Whereas Ian is saying, no, actually, this is just as fundamental. It's different, but it's
it's almost like a blind spot for like the first group you mentioned. That but that's the left hemisphere again. It just delineates like all science, this and the other is something other, and it's not part of what we're thinking about now. So then it just ends up not being seen even. It's like it's not recognized then. So but I think it's kind of almost courageous by McGilchrist to put that in and being.
Oh yeah, you could tell he was wrestling with it. You know, obviously the whole process of how the book came to be written and edited, and the chapter ended up being in the book. Yeah. You know, he was advised to take it out before the book was published, and all sorts of things, you know, several rounds of that before it went to Perspectiva for the actual publication.
Yeah, I think
it's. And obviously since then, it's the bit that keeps coming up in conversations, and it's clearly a lot of people have clustered around him now.
Yeah.
Coming in very much from that side now. He's got a lot of friends because they are seeing that side of it. You know, whether it's
I think he mentioned to the previous Archbishop of Canterbury,
Rowan Williams, yeah.
Rowan Williams. And Ian had said that that was the hardest part of the book to write, and the Archbishop just kind of silently smiled or something like that. You're trying to describe something that we've all been wrestling with for millennia.
Yeah, it's that's right. Yeah, you don't say.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm curious now that back to something a bit smaller, perhaps, and the agencies. Mm. You said something like that there's maybe even a causality, like the with a high level, and then how can you incorporate? Like, is that being now incorporated in system design? I mean, I'm thinking maybe like just something like the internet or something, and you create an internet service, and then if you get a certain amount of users, it starts having its own dynamics. And then is that suddenly becoming a part of the planning and the modeling that you, that we know more about some of these forces that start appearing, and then you treat it?
Yeah, although I would say, you know, obviously for the majority, the answer is no, you know, it isn't. Most people are not having this depth of thought about how these things are working. So they're just accepting it and using it and discovering the sort of polarizing effects that happen through this natural algorithmic promotion and demotion of things that, that based on people's interactions with them and based on attention and things like this, and algorithms based around these. And obviously people get frustrated with them. They see that, you know, it's doing things that we don't like, but it looks rationally the right thing to do. It looks like a rational algorithm, but I don't like what it produces. So I think most people are in that frustration mode, which is why I think today's announcement from, sorry, we didn't want to bring news into
that's
it.
Okay.
But obviously the whole Elon Musk thing.
It's been a big day.
the Elon Musk stuff has been talked about now for several months, actually. You know, it's been it's been on the cards for a while. So we've been talking about it, and it's just put everything back into in the spotlight, which is how social media manages itself or moderates. And nobody wants to use the word censor, but how it works is incredibly complex. And in fact, everything we've talked about is in it, because it's just full of people applying their brains to what they see. So it's not surprisingly, it's as complicated as everything we've already been talking about.
I mean, but they might have been struggling like 100 years ago when you suddenly had like newspapers everywhere, or you suddenly have broadcasting, like just radio. People think like, how is radio, does that have an agency in itself? Like how, like a radio show? I mean, but I guess it's like,
I said no, but that was the majority answer. But the key thing is, yes, there are people now who are actually analyzing the behavior of these emergent things, like, you know, this community of people in of that kind, or this community of people in that context, or whatever, and saying these things have lives of their own. And how is that?
I'm trying to, usually I like to think more on the abstract, but like, just if you want to have a group of people designing this, maybe you need different kinds of people together who are thinking together, who are kind of different brain hemisphere leanings. And then you could somehow together create a different kind of modeling, for example. I read about like ancient China. I started this week, finally, this I Ching book, The Book of Change. And there's something about, it describes how science, like the old ancient Chinese view of science, is so different from how we look at it. For example, causality is not necessarily an essential kind of like a requisite in the ancient view of it. It's more like there are many things that work in the same way. So and maybe then you might say, it's suggested by McGilchrist that some of the Chinese thinking at least is more right hemisphere based, or is they have the yin yang different approach to thinking, or like using your brain. So just sounds like there's a potential for progress in a sense, if it's like architecture and systems can be modeled in a different way.
Well, again, that's what I was saying, that this stuff is happening. And one of the things I've been writing about recently is this active inference lab, which is picking all of these ideas that I've listed off there about strong emergence of things with their own life and causality, and in fact with internal perspective as well. Which comes not just from McGilchrist, but from Solms and Friston, two of the people that I've also written about recently. And the umbrella that they've picked on is active inference. I'm sure they've picked on it because it's AI, the same as artificial intelligence. So it's become a bit of a buzzword, active inference. You could pick any of these, but it's all about this system architecture view of how does a big complex system work. And interestingly, obviously, cybernetics itself, you go right back to when it was originally coined. Well, if it goes back to Kubernetes from the Greeks, you know, from Plato originally, which was about governance. And when he talked about governance, he was talking about the populace being governed, you know, by its government, and how that happened and where all of those things came from. When Wiener wrote his book in the 1940s around the ASI conferences, that's what he meant as well when he talked about cybernetics. He meant governance in this more abstract sense of how do groups of people govern what they do. It only became cyber, you know, as in cybermen and automatons and sort of robotic sort of connotations, because of people who were doing work with it in computers, obviously very shortly after that. But cybernetics itself was always about how systems of people organize themselves. So not surprisingly, an awful lot of this stuff that's happening new on what appears to be a technology level is people who are like Elon Musk, motivated by a vision of how society itself should run. It's quite scary, actually. These are sort of idealists with some very strong views about these things.
But
they have very enlightened views about how the system should do it. That's the important thing.
But you kind of both, in a few words, are you connecting it all the way to like the spiritual is primary? It's kind of the values in a person's head sometimes who has the influence to do things that is shaping everything that goes below it down to how the system architecture is being implemented. Yes. So then you instantly have what should you call it, the view. I wouldn't use spiritual, but then you have united so many things pulled a line there immediately, which is very interesting. I also like I like the part you said now with if there are other things, just to describe then how McGilchrist is suggesting how the brain should work, is that we experience things through unfiltered through the right hemisphere, is then going on into the left brain, which then dissects it, puts it into bits and builds a model. And then the model is supposed to be transferred back into the right hemisphere and then being united into a bigger understanding. But then the critique from McGilchrist, I would say often, is that it stays in the left hemisphere and we just see the model and we don't integrate the model into anything else. Yeah. So we just get stuck.
Most of our manipulation in the world is using that model. So exactly. it's front and center. Most of the stuff that we do is using and the model in the left brain. Yeah,
exactly. And it's seductive also, and it gives a feeling of power and control and just certainty that we know everything. So, If some of like even the field you're talking about can be absorbed into something bigger, then that's kind of at a higher level what should happen then in a healthy human brain, just like at the bigger level. So that's sounds like a good progress. That's a bit of a complicated word in itself, but it sounds like it can be an improvement.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was just telling you, we talk about how it's all levels, how much is all being joined up by this thinking. And of course, the really scary thing, it's joined up here, there, but actually from there right down to below fundamental physics as well. So, I mean, the whole point of the stuff, as I say, Ian's done this. Ian McGilchrist's modeling has mostly been about the system of the two hemispheres and the corpus callosum and the amygdala and one or two other midbrain components that allow them to communicate and perform the sort of processing that you were just talking about, supporting these two different models of the world. Mark Solms has taken Carl Friston's work and done the set, really focused on the other slice, you know, from the hemispheres through the different midbrain components and how this process leads to, you know, consciousness and will and so on. And the bit that's it's been spotted by a lot of people and rejected, but people begin to realize actually this is very deliberate, is, and I don't think Mark Solms himself, because he's essentially concerned with human brains and people, isn't interested in fundamental physics, but he's using a lot of work, particularly around these emergent objects using information computation models that actually apply to everything in physics as well. And there are quite a few people, myself included, who have essentially an information-based metaphysics of how the whole world is built up. And so really this same picture applies to multi-layer systems.
I guess this is one of the really mind-bending things in McGilchrist's work. If how the brain works is also reflecting like an ontology at the deepest level, that you have two asymmetrical parts, two asymmetrical natures that are working together. In a sense, it makes sense. Like if you have two similar parts, there's a limitation to what you can build, for example. But if you have two asymmetrical parts, there's an eternity of things you can build.
It's just good system design, you know, and it's not surprising that it's evolved that way. If you have two parts that can do the same things, you've wasted a whole half of your resources.
Exactly. But it's a really, this reminds me of like when you first encounter the thought like what's outside of the universe when you're little and your brain starts hurting a lot, then this topic is a little bit the same, that the design of the brain emerges like evolutionary out of something much deeper, like a fundamental structure of
being. So, and that's why this new systems in development lab is very much latched onto the same things, because they're saying actually they've been working with AI and automation and ever more clever systems and applications, but they're saying actually the way the brain's evolved is in fact the best way to build a system. We couldn't do it any better other than following the same model that's evolved in the brain. So
you have this thought that maybe the best model of the brain is the brain itself. That
of course, the word here is model as well. Of course, this is the whole point of Solom's work, is it's not a model. That is actually how it works.
Yeah, that's
we can put a model on a page in a textbook, but the description of how it works with processing information isn't just a model. That is how it works.
Yep,
that's really mind blowing.
Yes, it is. I mean, I started thinking about this, and now we're off to yet another topic, but about cell biology and like the little kind of nano machines within the cell, like these motors with propellers,
mitochondria, and all the other propellers.
Yeah, and like it's so, and the coding technology of DNA, like you have this, like you have a certain amount of bits sort of in the chromosome, but then you can transpose different parts of it, and then you get a new gene, and it's just. Yeah. But especially just like these little machines that are transporting things, the shape of the molecules are essential to like the, and one is like shaped like a little rotor and with a little kind of tail on it, and it spins like 100,000.
Yeah, that's a famous case, the cilia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that also really kind of stops you a little bit in the tracks, and like we're trying to make nano machines ourselves, and then you suddenly look into one little cell on your arm, and then it's already there. It gives kind of a humility again, like nature, absolutely. and how nature is being built. So, and in that sense, I mean, you can look at the brain as this kind of almost like clunky two-part fat blob that is doing some trying to do some thinking, but when you look into it, there's so much more. It's a fascinating thought that the way to create it, if you want to replicate the human intelligence, for example, you will end up with another brain. As James Willis said in the previous episode on the podcast, if you want to make more human brains, we already know how to do that. pun on the same idea. But that really put all McGilchrist's work as well into put it in both a bigger scale and also down much to the more more molecular or beyond that even. Do you have any, if we're gonna try to wrap it up slowly here, any other last thoughts about McGilchrist and his work, or about science and where science is going, and if we are
it's a question I've asked McGilchrist several times now, is having decided that, you know, we've really confirmed it in this conversation, that the sense of the sacred is a really important part of an otherwise scientific book. Is some of us who've gone through a lot of this thought process, our own journeys of understanding these things, are comfortable hearing it and relating it to how things really work. But how do you talk to a typically science-informed, you know, modern person who hasn't gone through a 20-year sort of learning process of all this?
That is a great question.
And we always end up going back to the doing rather than the teaching, you know, and people always end up going back to, you know, things like mindfulness and meditation and just participation in other things. That's how people will learn these other things. But I always feel if we just keep doing it that way, it will always become this separate spiritual stuff that happens here, but isn't part of the real serious stuff here. That we'll always have this distinction between the serious rational stuff here and this other spiritual stuff, which is very good for us. We understand why it's good for us, but it's not part of this.
It's a great question. If you have to work on the environment, like the cultural environment, for example, if you have to start there, or practically how do you spend your day? I think if you spend 15 hours a day coding, like at a very low level, like logic coding, I think it's hard to have a balanced view on, because then the rest will become such a small part of your daily experience that it becomes a smaller thing, perhaps. I'm not sure. It's like,
yes.
But I mean,
well, I'm very encouraged by this particular group of developers at the Active Inference Lab who clearly have picked up on this much more enlightened model of how minds really do work and are actually bringing that thinking, systems thinking, into their daily coding. So be interested to see if that is actually any success in that.
Exactly. And if that is successful, then you would automatically have a shift because then if that proves to be a more productive approach, then that would be the preferred one, suddenly, or like increasingly.
And again, use the word shift. This is the other problem in a way, is that there's obviously, so long as science, you know, is quite correctly seen as having achieved an awful lot of progress, an awful lot of value and progress for humans, there is tremendous resistance to in any way compromising science by saying, well, we just need you to change this bit or throw out those ideas. And of course, this is what Kuhnian paradigms, you know, scientific revolutions was about, a lot of this stuff will probably happen in minority spaces before it ever really becomes mainstream. And when it does flip, you know, switch to becoming actually this is now mainstream thinking, it will actually have quite big downsides as well as upsides. An awful lot of stuff will be damaged in the process, I think.
Revolution. Yep. I mean, this is century big movements, so it's likely to take some generations, I'm guessing. Yeah. Again, but who knows, things are shifting. I think the minimum amount of change is 2 years in both for your own, like if something changes in your life, the third year it's become normal. Usually it depends, like if it's very severe things, but like normally a couple of years then you get used to something new, and it's some sense that has almost started to apply to the whole of society and the culture because of the internet, because there's no lag in spreading a new thought or a new idea. So but still,
this is one of the other tensions because of this huge decentralization of communications now. Everybody has their own experience of this. And so, as you say, at the individual level, it's, you know, learning it, using it, and becoming second nature. You know, it's like, you know, it's 3 years, three publication cycles, or whatever. Three updates to your favorite piece of software.
Exactly, third time. It's normal.
And it's like, well, it's just part of the furniture now. You use it. So, but in fact, and that's because, of course, it has become very much decentralized to being personally organized. Of course. The days of industrial revolutions driven by technology changes, it was much wider society needed to pick things up before individuals experienced the differences. And you said 100 years, I tend to use 80 years, but basically it's nominally three generations. It's not 3 years, it's three human generations. One to realize that there is something new, you know, two to actually exploit it and find it is useful in your life, and the third one, it's just part of the infrastructure, you don't even notice it anymore. So three generations.
I've heard something similar, that whatever happens after you're 30 years old becomes something new for you forever. It's not a part of the normal world that you grew up in.
So it's 30 years, like 330s or approximately 330. I say 80 years, you say 100 years. But it's that sort of cycle that's been repeating through history, actually. But it's being compromised now because we have this tension between stuff that happens at the speed of light in terms of communications and this speed of churn of personally configured systems. That we've got this massive tension between how long it takes to change society so that democracy still works next time around, whilst we have all of these other clever things we can do at the local level. And the gap has become huge. That's the bit we need to bridge with some of this later thinking.
Yeah. And I think the positive potential is huge to stay on, like to see the positive side of it. Okay, so I think we're going to wrap it up here. Do you have any plugs at the end? You have a great website, a blog where people can follow your work and many of these topics.
Cybertron.
Cybertron.
Post a link when you publish it.
Yep. Is that a pun on the Transformers planet?
No, but it's it's fundamental to the whole 20-year quest, which was realizing very early that it was about cybernetics, but realizing that cybernetics CY, by replacing it with PSY cybernetics, was more about psychology and human behavior, human interaction.
That is nice.
Psy. And the Tron, because obviously it's about all communications are electronic and all the automation is at the electronic level these days. So it was a deliberate pun on about three things just stuck together in one word.
That's very nice. I didn't know that.
I didn't really understand it as well as that when I did it, of course. It was just very roughly by word association. But now I've come to realize that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Cybernetics is about... I would really recommend everybody listening to check the blog, because it's such an interesting mix of of topics and also approach to it, and there's always something new there, something kind of thought-provoking.
It actually happened in this conversation as well. It's part of the problem is that I've realized a lot of this stuff is converging very fast, and everything new that comes along that appears enlightened is fitting like the next step of this model. You know, we've talked about these authors, these three or four authors as we've gone through here, and it's not standing still. So I'm continuing to blog, and it ends up being fairly disorganized. As you say, it almost appears to jump from topic to topic. There's always a thread of how they're connected, but they appear to be quite different topics. And stopping to try and write this down in some digestible form is my project for now. So it's quite tricky, because things are, even as I'm writing about things, something new happens in that space.
Yeah. No, but I think that's a nice expression of the whole challenge of doing these different things, because we might sense that as a coherence, but then how to, like, balancing the humanities and sciences is a very tricky thing, because of how we're shaped into thinking about science and humanities as two different modes of thinking almost. So not to open a huge topic at the end there, but I would say that I struggled much more with this combination as kind of like pushing two magnets towards each other. It's like it just didn't fit. But after spending now over 5 years with Dantes, Divine Comedy, and going into his whole cosmology and how he organizes everything and trains your brain to kind of just harmonize things, has made it much more natural and easy. So it just kind of, it all goes into this. For me, that's become the overall model that works for everything. It doesn't exclude anything. Yeah. It just takes it all in. So that's... That's one little tip if anybody's curious about that as well. Okay, well, with that, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been really fun. And thanks for listening, everybody. And see you again in another episode. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks for you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.